This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The majority of humans on Earth are likely unaware that their 190 governments met in Cancun, Mexico in December 2010. Their goal was to agree on ways to save the planet's climate from a brutal catastrophe. Did anything happen? It depends on who you talk to. I'm Alex Smith reporting. In this Radio EcoShock special, you will hear five different voices on what really happened inside the barricaded conference rooms and outside in the streets. Our guests are Harvard professor Robert Stavins, Damon Moglen, head of the climate campaign for Friends of Earth USA, Franklin Lopez, anarchist filmmaker, reporting from the Mexican climate activist scene, British radio broadcaster Phil England with the European perspective, and South American expert Nicholas Kozloff on Brazil, Bolivia, and the road not taken. If you think international talks to save the Earth are boring, listen again. While we were waved away by mainstream press, the usual suspects from the World Bank to the American arm twisters busily tried to rewrite the script. Or were they really looking for a way forward? Will the rich make big money from climate suffering? From the victims of flood, heat, drought, and rising seas and dying agriculture? Without our attention and action, that could be the New Deal. There is a nexus of American analysts who find the Cancun COP16 UN conference was a success. The New York Times headlines, climate talks end with modest deal on emissions. Harvard professor Robert Stavins says Cancun, quote, must be judged a success. His article on the Cancun talks, What Happened and Why, an assessment of the Cancun agreements, has been widely republished in left-of-center media, including climateprogress.org and Alternet. It is the most positive, upbeat analysis I could find. We'll begin with Dr. Stavins, followed by the more critical voices.
Radio EcoShock.
Robert N. Stavins is the Albert Pratt Professor of Business and Government. He is the director of the Harvard Environmental Economics Program, among many other titles. Dr. Stavins, you've written one of the most positive outcome articles that I've found. Could you outline what was accomplished at the Cancun meetings?
Well, the first thing to start with is to recognize that when climate change is addressed, it's going to be addressed fundamentally by individuals and by companies, and that they are going to be acting in compliance with laws that are set up by national governments and state governments or provincial governments in some cases, and that the role of an international agreement is essentially to weave together what takes place at the national levels. The agreement that came out of the discussions in Cancun, which is referred to now as the Cancun Agreements, does that weaving together. It does it with an approach which generically is referred to sometimes as a schedules approach. It is bottom-up. It is not a set of legally binding requirements like the Kyoto Protocol was. But one should recognize that what's important is what's actually achieved, not whether it's legally binding or not. So, for example, in the case of the Kyoto Protocol, which is a legally binding agreement, we should recognize that as a result of the nature of that agreement, it was never submitted to the U.S. Senate for ratification, so the U.S. doesn't participate. As a result of the nature of the agreement, Canada ratified the agreement, but it's going to miss its target by 35%, so it doesn't, in essence, participate. And for that matter, approximately 140 countries in the world don't even have any targets under the Kyoto Protocol, so being legally binding has no effect on them. So my point is that when you look at an international arrangement on climate change, you have to ask what does it actually do, not whether it's legally binding or not. The Cancun agreements, in essence, codify under the United Nations what had been agreed to by the countries of the world last year in Copenhagen when they produced what was called the Copenhagen Accord. The difference is that the Copenhagen Accord was noted but not adopted by the assembled group because the chair at the time, Prime Minister Rasmussen of Denmark, caved in, essentially, to protests from five countries that are not particularly important, in fact are unimportant in terms of their emissions in the world, but are essentially leftist and left-leaning governments, mainly from South America, led by Bolivia, but also Venezuela and Cuba, that protested not so much the climate agreement itself, because they didn't really care about climate change. They were essentially protesting international economic globalization and the like, and they did it through this venue. So as a result of that, because of a total of five countries not agreeing, the fact that 139 countries did agree didn't mean anything, because the interpretation last year was that the rules under which the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change operates, namely consensus, meant unanimity, and of course 139 out of 144 is not unanimity. Fortunately, this year in Cancun, when things came to more or less the same place, it was again Bolivia leading the charge, and at the last minute, which was, as I recall, something like 2 o'clock in the morning, or last Saturday morning, actually, at 2 o'clock, the chair, very talented woman, the foreign minister of Mexico, Ms. Espinosa, she simply said, look, you know, 193 countries are in agreement, one country is not. That sounds to me like consensus. The Cancun agreements are adopted, and bang went the gavel, and that was the end of that, and 139 countries stood up and applauded. So that's how it was adopted, and that's frankly the difference between this year in Cancun and last year in Copenhagen. It doesn't solve the climate problem all by itself, by no means whatsoever. It certainly does not put the countries of the world on track to stabilize concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent, which is what is scientifically believed to be associated with a maximum 2 degrees centigrade warming, which is a target that many governments have now accepted. The Cancun agreements themselves actually codify that as a legitimate target. They talk about 2 degrees centigrade. That's the first time it's appeared in a UN-sanctioned document with any teeth to it. So it's important in that, but it doesn't achieve it on its own. So I view it as a stepping stone. It's a path in the right direction. If you want to get from Chicago to New York, you can ask yourself whether or not, you know, the first few steps you take get you there, or you can ask whether or not you're heading in the right direction. And this is heading in the right direction. It is without a doubt, it goes without saying, that it's the best that could be achieved at this point. But it's quite important, because it is the best that could be achieved. It not only has within it the targets and actions laid out by some, I believe, as I recall, it's something in the order of 80 to 100 countries who filed, who associated themselves with the Copenhagen Accord, now therefore with this document, the Cancun Agreement. But it's important that those countries that did represent about 80% of at least 2005 CO2 emissions. So it is a substantial part of the most meaningful countries in the world. Going beyond the actual mitigation targets and actions themselves, the second thing the agreement does is that it elaborates in important ways on mechanisms for monitoring and verification. This was very important to some countries. It was a very important concession by China, it so happens. And now the countries will report their greenhouse gas inventories to an independent panel of experts who will monitor and verify the reports on emissions cuts and actions. Third, what the agreement does is sets up what's called a Green Climate Fund for mitigation and adaptation. Importantly, in my view, the agreement names the World Bank as the interim trustee of the fund. That was over the objections of some developing countries. And it creates an oversight board, half of which will consist of donor nation representatives. The agreement also establishes a goal by developed countries to mobilize to $100 billion per year by 2020 to support mitigation and adaptation in developing countries. That funding target would include both public resources and private resources. In other words, in terms of private resources, carbon markets and private finance, bilateral flows and multilateral flows, as well as that Green Climate Fund itself. Fourth, the agreement advances some initiatives for tropical forest protection. That is what's often referred to as REDD+, reduced deforestation and forest degradation. Here, what was achieved in Cancun was not as great as what some of us had anticipated, because there had actually been considerable progress already with regards to REDD+. So much remains to be done. There's a whole appendix there of information on what are the next steps. And in fact, one of the nice things they've done in Cancun is they've laid out a plan of action of what will happen during this year. Fifth, the Cancun agreements establish a structure to assess the needs and develop policies for technology transfer to developing countries for clean energy and adaptation to climate change. Again, this is just the beginning of that process, but it sets out the basic structure, and countries will continue to work on that. In addition, the agreement establishes something that's potentially quite important, namely a role for the market-based mechanisms from the Kyoto Protocol to continue, and this includes the Clean Development Mechanism, which is obviously important to many developing countries. Interestingly, it indicates that carbon capture and storage projects will be eligible for carbon credits under the CDM for the first time. And then finally, there are some special provisions for the countries of Central and Eastern Europe and for Turkey, who are Annex I countries, who are at relatively low income to many of the others. So that's the 32-page Cancun agreements, more or less in a nutshell. As a member of one of the leading national delegations said to me in Cancun only a few hours after the vote had taken place and it was adopted, as he said, it's incremental progress, but it's progress nonetheless. And that is exactly the way I would describe it. It is probably the most important step that it's been taken in these international negotiations in approximately the last 10 years. I understand that it's not satisfactory to what many people would like to see. That's perfectly okay. But you've got to recognize that this is the most important step taken in international negotiations in 10 years. To me, that makes the Cancun agreements and indeed the Cancun talks a success. My first criteria of success that I'd specified before the meetings in Cancun was that the UNFCCC should embrace the parallel processes that exist, the major economies forum, the G20, and others. And here I would celebrate the leadership of Executive Secretary Cristiana Figueres of Costa Rica, who's now running the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. I think she's done that and done it very well. She no longer views these processes as competition to the UNFCCC, but as possible contributors. My second criterion for success was that the three tracks of the negotiations, namely the Kyoto Protocol, the long-term climate agreements, and the Copenhagen Accord, would be merged into two, if not one. And that's happened, because essentially what's happened is that the Copenhagen Accords have now become the long-term climate agreement track within the UNFCCC negotiations. That, it turns out, is procedurally a very, very important step forward. And then finally, my last criteria for success was that the Cancun meetings would maintain sensible expectations and thereby develop effective plans. And I think they've accomplished that. Overall, I think that the acceptance of the Cancun agreements by essentially, I think it's 193 countries, suggests that the international diplomatic community may now recognize that incremental steps in the right direction are better than acrimonious debates over what are fundamentally unachievable targets.
I know your time is limited, and I really appreciate your explanation of this. It's one of the best we've had. You've been listening to Harvard climate policy expert Dr. Robert N. Stavins. Thank you so much, sir, for your valuable time.
My pleasure.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Governments around the world sent ministers and experts to the December 2010 climate conference in Cancun, Mexico, but they wouldn't do much without pressure from citizens represented by thousands of non-governmental organizations, the NGOs, calling for real climate action. Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth are two of the best, and Damon Moglen has worked for both. He started out with Friends of Earth in Washington back in 1984. Damon has campaigned for the last 20 years on climate, energy, and nuclear issues with Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and most recently as Global Warming Director for Greenpeace USA. Now he's back with Friends of Earth, and he's the new Climate and Energy Director there. Damon Moglen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I appreciate you coming on at the last minute. We're doing a go-round, getting different voices and reactions to the COP16 Climate Conference. Let's start with Friends of the Earth. Did you get anything you were hoping for?
Well, I think that these negotiations are complicated, and unfortunately, powerful countries were very pitted in blocking real forward motion. But I think first of all, what we saw was that the UN process is still vital and robust, and that there is really a meaningful opportunity for these negotiations to move in a positive direction. I think that is good news. I think that there has been some good news on the international financing piece, where there is money being made available for developing countries who are in dire need of funding to help them to deal with adaptation and mitigation of climate impacts. Some of these countries really are on the cutting edge, and already people's lives are being affected, and in some cases even people are dying because of climate change impact. So that's the good news, but unfortunately it's very clear that the bad news far outweighs the good news. We did not get the agreement we urgently need.
To add pressure to those governments inside the security barriers, what sort of actions happened outside trying to keep that world eye on these talks?
Well, I think, as you said in your summary at the beginning, that thousands, literally, of non-governmental organizations around the world have been lobbying their governments and have been making demands. Thousands of corporations have been doing likewise, and there are huge pressures being brought to bear on governments by corporations, the fossil fuel industry in particular, oil, gas, and coal, who are really doing everything they can to stop these negotiations moving in a meaningful direction. But I think people power is having an impact. We see many governments who are taking the position that we've got to be acting and that the science is real and that this is a overwhelming global problem. And I think that we saw that in Cancun as well. There were organizations being represented by all kinds of people, both within the buildings of the negotiations and outside in the streets. And there were important and meaningful protests bringing together very broad coalitions of people. That's among the most powerful and important thing that we saw during the negotiations, that huge coalitions are forming and that those move across the lines from indigenous people to environmental activists, to labor activists, to people who are concerned about how we grow our food and what we do with it. So I think that there is some very powerful and benign forces that are working now together and in exciting and important ways.
I know our government in Canada went to the meeting to make sure there was no limit on fossil fuel emissions. We love our tar sands, and we've just got to pump them out. And I don't know whether Obama, with the new Republican elections, had any real support to do anything. What was your feeling? Did the United States play a positive role, or was it actually blocking some things?
No, I think, unfortunately, the United States has played a very, very negative role in these talks, just as they played an incredibly negative role in the Copenhagen talks. U.S. Ambassadors were really bullying and threatening other countries. I think that we've seen through the WikiLeaks that the U.S. has done a lot of really unpleasant and nasty backroom dealing. In a way, the most sad part of this is that President Obama, who ran so strongly on climate change issues and reflected such an important and valued position on climate change, has been completely missing in action. He has really failed to use the bully pulpit of the presidency to talk about the reality of climate science, the reality of climate change, the incredible impacts that we face, not only in our own country, but because of our greenhouse gas emissions over decades. What are the climate impacts that our country and our mistaken energy policy are creating around the world? So unfortunately, I think that what we see is an administration that has been shockingly similar to the Bush administration rather than dramatically different. So the U.S. did play a role at these talks of not only trying to block a legally binding agreement, but has pushed very hard for instead emissions reductions to be a matter of so-called pledge and review, which basically means countries are going to be able to say, oh, well, we'd like to bring about these kind of emissions reductions, and we pledge to abide by them. That is a far cry from the legally binding agreement that we need that is going to require science-based emissions reductions. So the U.S., unfortunately, has really played a spoiler's role in this, and I think that activists and organizations operating in the United States have got to come on harder and stronger. Finally, I do want to make a comment about the role that our new political reality in our Congress plays. Many people talk about the ways in which the split of Republican-Democrat House and Senate in our country are really a problem for future negotiations. I flatly reject that. Our Constitution is actually very, very clear. The President of the United States is responsible for negotiating international foreign policy. And the President, actually, President Obama, has used opposition in the Congress to justify his lack of forward motion on climate change issues. And that's unacceptable. The President is empowered to go out and negotiate an agreement. And that agreement is not dictated by the United States Congress. foreign policy was never supposed to be dictated by the Congress in that sense. And I think that all we need to do is look at arms control agreements, nuclear agreements, to see the ways in which the president has historically, on issues of the most demanding international importance, the president has always gone out ahead of the Congress and negotiated agreements. And that's what we need this president to do. This is a brilliant, dynamic president who understands these issues in a way that I don't think many other of our presidents has. What he's got to find out is courage and vision.
Well, that was really well said, I thought. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we're talking with Damon Moglen from Friends of Earth. He's currently in San Francisco, but I guess you work out of Washington, D.C. Is the climate movement forming, or are we getting stalled? So many people are kind of complacent in fossil fuel wealth. And I want to ask you, too, is this United Nations process going to work, or is it creating false hope? What's your take?
Well, I think we have to have hope. It's been suggested that this whole climate change issue is kind of a giant and perhaps the most important IQ test that the human species has ever faced. And I think that's true. And for the moment, we're failing. But I think that we have the ability to take this on. We got ourselves into these problems. And I think that we can truly create both domestic policies and international policy that can protect our planet and protect ourselves and the wildlife and ecosystems around us. I think the bottom line here is that the UN process, like any other political process, has its problems, has its failures, has its flaws. But given that climate change is of international importance and implication, we need to support the international process. We need to support these UN negotiations. What we each of us as activists need to do is demand that our countries represent the science, represent the demands of the people, and negotiate in a transparent and committed way at these talks, and not as the lapdogs of corporate interests who are about money and not about our environment and about the future of our children and grandchildren. So the international process is something that I think we must remain committed to, but what we ourselves as activists have to do is demand that our governments participate in a meaningful way. The talks are only as good as the member states involved, and right now I think it's fair to say that both the Canadian government and the U.S. government have not participated in these talks in the effective and necessary way that we need.
In the past, Friends of Earth has been really good about exposing the banking relationships to coal production and things like that. How do you feel about the World Bank being proposed to look after this mythical $100 billion climate fund?
Well, these are serious problems. Friends of the Earth and many other organizations have flatly rejected the idea that if we're going to have a global climate fund, and there was some good forward motion in Cancun on this front, it must not be overseen by the World Bank. This is yet another example of putting the very people who got us into a lot of our problems in charge of getting us out of those problems, and that doesn't make any sense. The fox isn't supposed to be in charge of the hen house. The good news is that there were greater commitments made to building an international green climate fund. The good news is that it was recognized that the UN is going to need to play a greater role, and the UN and FCCC, the UN entity dealing with this. But as you've mentioned, for example, the World Bank is supposed to be on the trustees, and that causes some real cause for concern. I think that we need a new kind of solution to these problems, not the old failed ones. So we've got some serious work to do, and Friends of the Earth has, as you've said, historically worked very hard to kind of out these financial and business interests when they have sought to hijack these kind of processes, and we're certainly going to continue to do that. But I think that there's actually some real hope in where the Cancun talks managed to get us in terms of more money and a greater commitment to an international funding process.
Well, moving forward with the UN talks as we must, how do we move forward as we head towards Durban in 2011?
Well, I think there are two critical issues here. First of all, as you and your listeners know, we have a landmark agreement on climate, the so-called Kyoto Protocol, which is going to be up for renewal in 2012. And one of the most shocking things that happened during the Cancun talks was an effort by a number of countries, including remarkably Japan, to in effect assassinate the Kyoto Protocol, to argue that we don't need that protocol and that we should let it lapse. That is not at all the case. And what this is really about is under Kyoto, governments had to make legally binding commitments. They have real obligations to bring down their emissions. So first of all, what we need to be doing is we need to see the Kyoto Protocol renewed for a new period of time during which these obligations are at least maintained, if not increased. That's the environment in which we need to be negotiating in Durban towards a new, legally binding, science-based, equitable international climate agreement. So, you know, there are these two things. We need to hold the line on Kyoto. We need to make sure that we're negotiating in an atmosphere of legally binding obligations. And we need to negotiate a broader, more demanding agreement in line with the science for Durban. And so, you know, we've got our work cut out ahead of us, but I think we can manage both of those things.
Damon, as we wrap up, can you give us a website or two where people can follow up?
Well, absolutely. I mean, people are very welcome, and we'd love to see people coming to our website. That's www.foe.org, friendsoftheearth.org. And certainly there are many, many other organizations that are doing great work. You mentioned Greenpeace. I think that Greenpeace's analysis is also very important. So that would be www.greenpeace.org. So those are two of them. But there are an array of wonderful organizations doing work, and I encourage people to look at various sites, and there are certainly many, many places to be going for good information.
Okay. Speaking for Friends of Earth, our guest is Damon Moglen, Climate and Energy Director and a lifetime environmental activist. Thank you, Damon. I hope we can talk again as the struggle continues.
I hope so too, Alex. Thank you for giving me some time to talk with you today.
Right. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are listening to a Radio EcoShock special assessment of the Cancun Climate Talks held in Mexico in early December 2010. It's your planet, your kids' future. I'm Alex Smith with five interviews, five voices on what you need to know. This is Radio EcoShock, and when we need a critical eye on the street, Franklin Lopez is the man. He's a cameraman, he's a producer, he's a super video editor, an anarchist, an activist. He's based in Vancouver, but roaming where the action is. As the stimulator, his free-swinging videos get millions of views. His video podcast is It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. And that says a lot about Franklin, I would say. In December 2010, Frank was at the United Nations Climate Conference in Cancun, Mexico. He was on the streets. Frank, I'll bet you were not there to get sound bites from the usual talking heads. Why did you go to Cancun?
Well, primarily I went to Cancun to screen a film that I just completed called NCIF. And just shortly, it's a film based on the ideas of Derek Jensen, and I felt that the film was really made for environmental activists. And I wanted to have it ready for the COP15, but that was just physically impossible. But the second reason I went there was to report on the grassroots activism that was going to happen around the COP16. So I joined a caravan of buses from Chiapas, from the city of San Cristobal, about 250 of us divided into five buses, 23 hours through the treacherous roads of Mexico. And we finally made it through five military checkpoints and to one of the two activist camps that were set up in Cancun.
Did you get a hard time from people as you were going there? And were these camps hospitable to alternative media?
Both camps were very grassroots. Actually, the folks who organized the bus caravan were organized in a space called Espacio Mexicano, or Mexican Space. And that was a collaboration between a bunch of different groups, including Otros Mundos, Friends of the Earth, and Oxfam. I ended up not staying at that camp. I went to the Villa Campesina Mexico camp because that's where the anti-capitalist bloc, they were calling themselves anti-cop, were set up. And both camps were, you know, it's an unbelievable way of organizing. And I wish, aside from the content of the actual camps, which we can get into later, that way of organizing really facilitates people taking time off of work to actually do something worthwhile for their world. For example, both camps had giant circus-type tents where people could actually sleep under unless you had your own tent. Both camps provided free food throughout the week. And then, of course, there were speakers and such throughout the both camps. At the Villa Campesina camp, they even had a Wi-Fi internet connection that was amazingly powerful, and I was able to produce media from that actual camp. And, of course, there was electricity. The showers weren't cold, but at least you can take a shower. And just some of the realest people I've ever met within the activist scene.
We see the climate camp model has happened in the UK and Britain, but hardly anywhere in North America that I'm aware of. Do you know of some climate camps that have happened in Canada or the United States?
Yeah, I know that this summer in Montreal, there was a climate camp, although I was not able to make it. But even like within the context of outside of the climate activism, the G20 in Toronto, I mean, that would have been an amazing place to actually have something like that. Although one of the organizing groups there did something that I had never seen done in Canada, and it maybe has to do with my little time in Canada. But they actually provided food during one of the actions, food before the march and food after the march. And that really made it easy and affordable for people to do this. So I think that for organizers in Mexico, that was an amazing way to get people who are essentially poor. I mean, most of the people that came to these camps were rural Mexicans who were there to basically say that the climate is destroying their crops, the climate is affecting their lives. They had some clear demands.
So there is an awareness in Mexico about climate change issues.
Well, that's a tricky question, right? Because when you look at the COP15, the amount of people that actually went to that particular mobilization was, you know, I wasn't there, but just looking at the reports, was way larger, like by a huge long shot than Mexico. I mean, the Cancun mobilization, some estimates say, like, you know, it tops out of 5,000 people. Now, when you consider the dire situation that we're in, these mobilizations really matter. They are some of the most important activist work that we can do, regardless of whether or not you sit on the, you know, anarchist side, which is, you know, wants to reject the talks altogether, or if you're part of the people who want to beg the government for change. I think, in a sense, like climate activism, it's a very privileged type of activism. People in the first world can really actually take the time to look at these, the science, and look at these predictions that are going to happen, even the stuff that's happening right now, and actually do activism around something that may or may not affect them in the present, right? When you look at places like Mexico or Latin America, they have their plate full. They're already dealing with land issues. They're already trying to preserve their culture. There's still many indigenous people who live in Mexico who are day in, day out trying to protect, you know, what's left of their land. So to ask them, you know, they do understand what climate change is what it's doing, but they also have, in a sense, like reality is at their door, and they're fighting, you know, super projects like dams, like highway expansions, forced relocations into what they're calling almost like rural cities is what they're calling in Chiapas, I think, where they're basically trying to get, you know, campesinos, like farmers, to move to these, you know, sort of like planned communities and basically leave the land alone for the government to use for whatever else.
What were some of the actions that you saw there that could inspire us?
Well, like I said, I was there mostly to report on the activities of the anti-capitalist bloc. And they had certainly a small contingent within the larger mobilization there. On their very first action, which they actually held a spokes council the day before to decide what they wanted to do, was to go to an agency called the Profepa. And the Profepa, it's an acronym that basically, it's the Ministry of the Environment in Mexico. And these are the folks who are supposed to be protecting the environment, but just like in the United States or in other countries, you know, they actually facilitate the building of super projects like dams, et cetera. So the action was to try to go in front of the actual building, the actual government building. And since people felt that the Profepa was, pardon my French, was pooping on them, then they were going to poop on the Profepa. So they gathered an enormous amount of excrement, and they had a catapult, and they were actually headed over there. But, you know, the action was pretty well known, and riot police blocked the way. So the only people who got pelted with the poop were the riot police.
Right, to the barricades for sure. Were there any signs of violence, or did things go peacefully?
You know, when you go to protests in North America, you certainly see like large numbers of police, really well armed, usually with less lethal weapons, tear gas, flashbang grenades and whatnot. In Mexico City and Cancun, the police had fully automatic rifles. You saw it everywhere. It was like an occupied city. And even within the face of that potential police violence, people were amazingly fearless in confronting the police. But people understood also that they were outnumbered. Also, people understood that there was an action that was, there was reached consensus on that action, and that people were not going to break consensus. So as much as there were some people who really wanted to have it out with the cops and try to get to the actual building, once it was understood that there was probably one policeman for every protester, the marchers decided to just basically turn back and just have a party.
You say anti-capitalist, so are you saying that these talks really just shouldn't happen because governments are betraying us anyway, or that it's all going to the World Bank? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, one of the things that really bothers me about the environmental movement when I look at the big NGOs, the big NGOs, as they are called, is that they do not have an anti-capitalist analysis. You know, I'm not saying that things couldn't have gone this way if the world was ruled by socialism or communism. But in the end, capitalism is the name of the game right now, and capitalism requires exponential growth in order to survive. And we live in a finite world, and we can't do that. So the anti-capitalists have a very nuanced but yet very clear analysis that in order for the destruction of the planet to end, we need to end capitalism. We really need a full system change. And that was an analysis that was even like outside the anti-capitalist bloc. So as we have seen through the years when it comes to these talks and, you know, groups like the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank and the G20, when these folks meet, they're usually don't have the people's future, the people's well-being at stake. So as anti-capitalists, and I include myself in that group, we really think that what we do at these mobilizations is show people the farce that's happening behind the fence and basically hope that our discourse makes them change their tactics so that they actually use tactics that are going to lead them to victory, that are going to lead us to actually protect our world. To a certain degree, like I'm amazingly disappointed in Cancun on many different levels. On another, I'm glad that things failed behind the fence as they were expected, even though the folks behind the fence claimed victory, and that people start to see the reality that we don't have unlimited time to do this. So we really need to think of what are the things that are going to stop the destruction of the planet. And I think that's the most important thing that the anti-capitalist bloc brings to the table.
Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
The movement in Mexico concerning the COP16 was extremely divided. The two main camps, as I mentioned, Via Campesina and Espacio Mexicano, or Mexican Space, had some serious infighting, which prevented them from doing mobilizations together. I also saw the big NGOs, the big NGOs, doing big actions to garner media attention, and they didn't seem that plugged in with the grassroots groups. And so, you know, once again, you have egos, you have something they call in Latin American protagonism. Everybody's just trying to be the most badass activist group out there instead of jointly going forward and making a larger splash as a massive group of people. In that sense, you know, not only did the talks fail behind closed doors, but I'm really sad to say that the movement is headed by the so-called movement is headed by folks who are more interested in showing that they can do these actions and later garner more donations or more foundation money or whatever, where in the end the problem requires a much more visionary and a much more long-term view. And I just didn't see that in Cancun, unfortunately.
We're going to see that in some of your film, End Civ. I want to wrap up with that. First of all, what does End Civ stand for? And tell us a little bit about the film and how people can find it.
Yeah, the film EndCiv means End of Civilization, and as I mentioned, is inspired by the works of Derek Jensen, in which his main premise or his main proposal is that civilization has to end for us to survive. And within that premise, he basically says that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. It's not a really hard idea to grasp, but I try to do my best to give Derek's work, which is an amazingly rich work, some justice. And people can see clips of the film, or they can buy the DVD at endciv.com. That's endciv.com.
Great. We've been talking with Franklin Lopez, and he's a producer and a multimedia kind of giant in a way, a one-man guy who also works with a team of other people, but is taking the idea of Be the Media to heart, and I think giving us a leadership role in that. So thanks a lot for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
And thanks for having me. I've been a fan for years.
Okay. This is Radio EcoShock, churning over the results of the 2010 COP16 climate talks in Cancun, Mexico. Our guest is British broadcaster and host of Climate Radio, Phil England. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, I want to start by thanking you for the fantastic radio shows on last year's Copenhagen talks from you and your team at Resonance FM in London. It was simply the best coverage of the conference, inside and outside. What a zoo to try and convey all that.
That's very very kind of you to say so. It's also very exhausting. And, it's also quite a complex thing to get your head around, even if you're actually inside the negotiated conference center.
Well, these UN conferences are so complex. There's thousands of delegates, many speaking bureaucratic baffle-gab, it seems to me, and thousands more NGOs from all over the world speaking many languages. Help me hash through the results of this conference. So where would we start?
Well, there are lots of people that got good things to say about it. I mean, I think the main upside is that it has saved the multilateral process. The idea that all countries, all 193 countries in the world that are part of the UN can come together and try and work this out collectively so that everybody, in theory, has an equal say. That process, the UN process, has been saved, a lot of people are saying, because it has been on a very rocky road over the last few years. So I think that's a good outcome. It could have gone to kind of bilateral processes and more unrepresentative bodies like the G20, for example.
Firm limits to greenhouse gases were not set, but at least there was this shared vision, a goal of 2 degrees of warming maximum. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, the big downside, if you like, is that no rich country has agreed to raise their targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions. So, overall, we're still on a pathway towards catastrophic levels of climate change. That's the bottom line message. But in the text, developed country parties are urged to increase their ambition in line with the recommendations in the IPCC's latest report. But that would only give us a 50-50 chance of keeping within 2 degrees C. And of course, we also know from the last IPCC report that serious impacts are going to happen at lower temperatures than previously thought. And a majority of countries support a 1.5 degrees C target or lower. So it's a bit odd that they're still insisting on going with this unsafe target of 2 degrees C and not having any means of achieving it at all. Bolivia, of course, made a very principled stand in the last couple of hours of the negotiation, saying that it would not agree to a text that leads to a 4 degrees C world, and saying that this would implicate it in genocide and ecocide. So that's pretty much the overall shared vision aspects of the text.
Phil, is the proposed $100 billion Green Fund real or more empty promises? What is your take?
Analysis have been done of the what was called the fast track funding, which was the money that rich countries promised to poor countries for signing on to the Copenhagen Accord from last year. And basically, hardly any of that is new money. And what's starting to appear is that rich countries want to offer this money not as grants, but as in the form of loans. So the countries that have done nothing to cause the problem of climate change are being asked to pay for cleaning up the mess with interest on top. That's a very poor development. Also, this $100 billion that is being talked about for 2020, they're hoping to scale it up to $100 billion by 2020. It's very unclear as to where that money is going to come from, and there's a lot of talk about it coming from the carbon markets. And the problem with that is that it's a way for rich countries to buy their way out of emissions cuts at home, and it shifts the burden again onto the poor countries, which is the wrong thing that should be happening. When you look at the deal that everybody signed, the framework that everybody's operating under in these talks is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change from 1992, which everybody, including the US, signed up to, and has a lot of stuff about fairness in it and who's responsible and who should be paying who. And this is now all seems to be taking a rather strange turn, you know, that the rich countries are trying to do their best to wriggle out of their responsibilities.
It sounds like climate imperialism, really, the way you describe it.
Well, in a sense, and there's a very worrying trend, well, worrying question mark over the role of the World Bank in all of this. I mean, basically, the G77 plus China, the 130-odd countries that are the poor majority at the UN, are basically have had on the table for some years now an opposition to any involvement for the World Bank. I mean, they basically see it as it's the institution that has turned poor countries into debt slaves, and it's continuing to fund fossil fuel projects, you know, right as of today. It's the organization that makes dirty development possible and has done nothing to reform itself. So the G77 plus China, have their proposal that's been on the table for years now is that all climate finance should be under the democratic control of the UN and that there should be no role for the World Bank. It's unclear as to how that is going to play out over the next year. Currently, there is a token role for the World Bank, and the World Bank is making a big play to put itself at the center of all this in terms of its PR. But really, NGOs have got a lot of, and civil society have got a lot of work to do over the next year to try and to make that one come good.
How do you see the RED plan for protecting forests working out?
During the negotiations themselves, there were major concerns about the safeguards included in the forestry section of the agreement. Basically, there was no clear definition even of what constituted a forest, which essentially meant that you could have a perverse incentive in all this, where logging companies and countries could be essentially paid to cut down long-standing old-growth forests and replace it with short-growth timber for future logging. And for the climate, that's not a good solution at all. And it's been shown that one of the best ways for preserving the forest is actually to enhance the land rights of the indigenous people that actually live there. If we did that, there is evidence. There was a study in The New Scientist which said that that's the best way of protecting forests. It was a survey done over a number of years covering about 220 forests, a global study, and that was its conclusion. At the end of the conference, it's not a good sign that indigenous people are up in arms about what's currently on the table. So again, a lot of work to be done over the coming year.
We are talking over the Cancun Climate Conference results with Phil England, host of Climate Radio. Find his blog at climateradio.org. And you mentioned to me also in an email, Phil, that there is still a loophole for the rich countries. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that's another thing which has been a firm decision on it has been put off until next year. But there's a rich country loophole called LULUCF, which is about land use change and forestry, and the way that rich countries account for that in their national emissions inventories. Essentially, it's been exposed as a big loophole. The good thing is that none of the bad options that are on the table haven't been agreed to. So again, there is still an opportunity for campaigners to get that one sorted satisfactorily over the coming year.
As we prepare for those next round of talks in Durban, South Africa in December 2011, do you have any more tips for listeners and activists, things they should be watching for or doing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to show is that there are ways of raising finance to fund this climate deal so that we get adequate funding to pay poor countries' adaptation and climate changing impacts, and also to help them develop in a clean way. We need to show that we can get adequate funds for that that don't come from the carbon markets that are realistic. And the best option that's on the table is the so-called Robin Hood tax. I don't know if you've come across that in Canada. It's a big campaign here in the UK. It's a kind of rebranded take on the Tobin tax,
right,
which is this small tax on financial transactions. And it can raise, you know, hundreds of billions, just a very small tax. And that should really be given serious consideration. And I think a campaign, ramped up campaign for that, would be something seriously to get our teeth into next year.
I'm Alex Smith from the UK. You've been listening to longtime radio host Phil England helping with the Cancun Climate Conference wrap-up. Get more from my show blog at ecoshock.info and certainly from Phil's site. Check it out at climateradio.org. Phil England, you are one of the people I learn from, I have to tell you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks, Alex. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Just like football or baseball, when it comes to the global climate crisis, countries form teams of common interest. It's pretty hard to understand the negotiations game without even knowing the team names. The Americans we know, sure, and the European Union, but who are the G77, BASIC, ALBA, AOSIS? Do they matter? Can they influence the final outcome? And really, when you get down to it, do the annual United Nations climate conferences have any hope of saving our climate? Here to help us, especially with voices from the Global South, is New York-based writer Nicholas Kozloff. He has a doctorate in Latin American history from Oxford and two recent books, Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left in 2008, and in 2010, No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet. Nicholas Kozloff has appeared on major television networks. Nicholas, it's great to have you back on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, the 2010 COP16 summit, the annual attempt to save the climate, has wrapped up in Cancun, Mexico. Can you give us a brief rundown of the players, those country groups with the acronym names?
Sure. Well, you have obviously the European Union and the United States, and then you have this geopolitical bloc, which is fairly recent, called BASIC, which is Brazil, China, India, and South Africa. Then you have the G77, which is an older geopolitical bloc, which in theory represents the interests of impoverished third world countries, but which in practice has become a bit diffuse. Then you have AOSIS, which is the small island nations, which are very menaced and threatened by global climate change. And then in addition, if that weren't befuddling enough, you have the ALBA countries, the more radical Latin American bloc that's been pushing a more ambitious climate change proposals in recent years.
What is going on with Brazil, and why is that country important to our climate?
I was cautiously optimistic at a certain point that activists might make a friendly overture towards Brazil in the hope that they might take a progressive stance on climate change. But since then, as a result of disclosures in the WikiLeaks scandal, I've come to reverse my position, and I'm very skeptical at this point that Brazil, unfortunately, will be able to counteract the United States, Europe, not to mention its counterparts in the BASIC group, China, India, and South Africa. I was initially a bit optimistic because in the first round of Brazil's presidential election, which occurred just recently, you had Marina Silva of the Green Party actually garnering 19% of the vote, which is really unprecedented. That's perhaps the level that you might expect the Green Party of Germany to achieve in an election. And so for a Green Party candidate to get that kind of vote share in Brazil is really unprecedented and should be welcomed. So I interpreted that as a sign that perhaps environmental consciousness was growing in Brazil. And for other reasons, I thought Brazil might be pliable in some ways because Brazil forms part of the pink tide of leftist regimes in South America, which have come to power in recent years. And so even though Brazil hasn't made climate change policy its major focus, like Bolivia, Venezuela, and Cuba, and those more radical Latin American countries, I figured that as long as Brazil is part of that pink tide wave, that maybe activists might be able to persuade it to take a more friendly or a more progressive stance. Unfortunately, I don't really see many signs of that. You ask Brazilian high officials, for example, the environment minister, Isabella Teixeira, who I had the opportunity to interview in New York when she came up to the United Nations, and they'll tell you that we have very good faith in the negotiating process. We're negotiating within BASIC. We're negotiating within the G77. Unfortunately, there were some recent disclosures which in the WikiLeaks scandal, which hinted that Brazil is maybe not an equal opportunity negotiator.
And they're becoming a major oil producer themselves. And I asked you, too, you know, why that country is so important to our climate. I know that you've written a book about the Amazon and the importance of the Amazon rainforest, but isn't Brazil also now the third largest emitter or something like that? Am I off base on that?
Yes. I think that historically, the United States, Europe, and maybe Russia have contributed greatly to global warming. And yet, in future decades, and already, it's increasingly the developing countries, China, India, and Brazil, that are going to play a more predominant role in global warming. And already, Brazil is the third largest emitter, and most people don't grasp that. And that's largely as a result of the deforestation in such sensitive ecological regions as the Amazon. And also, Brazil is going to develop offshore oil, and it's pursuing its great power projection into the Atlantic in the hopes of developing offshore oil reserves. But for the most part, its emissions are related to the deforestation. And unfortunately, because agribusiness is so politically connected in Brazil, it's difficult to see how Brazil is going to vastly clamp down on agribusiness, for example, even though the Lula administration has stated its aim to reduce deforestation, and in recent years there has been some reduction in deforestation, but it's politically rather dubious. And I think it's also a vast region in the Amazon that's difficult to enforce, and so difficult to protect from deforestation. I certainly welcome all of those initiatives, but I think that Brazil, despite its claims, is going to have to adhere to binding reductions as opposed to non-binding reductions, and that's been the problem in all of these international climate negotiations, because it's all non-binding at the end of the day, and who is to make sure that Brazil will actually reduce its deforestation? There's no international mechanism to ensure that that happens.
Yeah, well, you raise some really good points, because I think in the mechanics of the Cancun Climate Agreement, there has been a lot of hoopla about the forest protection. RED, as it's called, R-E-D-D, is one of the bright spots. But it seems that in their industrial tree farms count as forests, and you're still allowed sustainable use like logging. There's no protection for Aboriginal people that I can see. What is your take about this forest agreement?
I'm a little skeptical about capitalistic means to reduce deforestation. And so basically, I think ideally the global north should just reduce its own emissions as opposed to somehow protecting nations of the global south from deforestation. It's sort of a bizarre approach to reducing emissions. That said, I'd be open to the notion of a RED program. My concern also is that who is going to disperse these climate change funds? And if you notice in Cancun, one of the results of the conference was that they agreed that the World Bank would be dispersing the funds. I have severe reservations about that. I think Robert Zoellick, who is the United States trade representative during the Bush administration, was lobbying hard for the World Bank to disperse the funds in addition to Japan and the usual suspects. And so given the World Bank's environmentally dubious record in the third world, I don't think that they should be the ones that are dispersing funds for RED, for example.
Well, right. I mean, the World Bank has been funding coal plants and other very destructive climate things. And, you know, a lot of the suspect characters seem to be kept employed by this Cancun Agreement, things like the Clean Development Mechanism, which has been horribly abused in some places. And then the Wall Street traders, they're going to be thrilled to see they get a climate trading mechanism to make money trading on pollution. Do we have to be anti-capitalist to say that these things have already shown they're very unlikely to work?
I certainly share your skepticism on those grounds. And moreover, I think that even though it's claimed that this Cancun Climate Summit was an incredible success, and you read the glowing press reports, I'm a little skeptical that we're going to be able to make the kinds of climate change reductions that are called for.
You have been listening to Nicholas Kozloff on Radio EcoShock. I recommend Kozloff's latest book, No Rain in the Amazon. Find out more at his website, nicholaskozloff.com. If you have trouble finding that, you can get that link and many more in my blog entry on the Cancun Climate Talks at ecoshock.info. That's it for our Radio EcoShock Cancun Climate Summit coverage. You heard Dr. Robert Stavins from Harvard, Damon Moglen at Friends of Earth USA, Franklin Lopez, the anarchist filmmaker from the Mexican climate scene, British radio broadcaster Phil England with the European perspective, a real treat to have the host of Climate Radio on the air, and South American expert and author Nicholas Kozloff on Brazil, Bolivia, and the Road Not Taken. If you tuned in partway or want to listen again, download this free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, going hard to give you a ringside seat as humans decide whether to sink or swim. Thank you for listening.